Hello, this is Jill Burridge welcoming you to the summer 2026 issue of our quarterly magazine programme, which is produced by Mark. This being one of the 4 weeks of the year when our news editors get a week off. We begin with an interview from 2013 in which Rob Pearman talks to Madeleine Burton, the then news editor of the Hearts Advertiser. She retired after 38 years at the paper in 2017.
Hello, this is Rob Pearman. I'm delighted to have in the studio with me today Madeleine Burton, who is the news editor of the Hearts Advertiser. And of course, without the Hearts Advertiser, we wouldn't have any programmes to make because we rely, and have done for many years, on the news that you and your colleagues produce. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you very much.
What I want to be clear on is what area Hearts Advertiser covers, because we get to stories from different parts of the district. What is your area of coverage?
Well, the main areas are St Albans and Harpenden as the two biggest towns. We cover the villages, Wheat, Hampstead, Redbourne, London, Coney Heath. We also go out to parts of Radlett and Shenley. So the whole of the St Albans district, plus a little bit of Hartsmere Borough, we cover.
Okay. And I think if I'm correct, in the old days, you probably had different editions for different areas. Those were in the golden days when money was no problem. But
yeah, in those golden days. Yes, we did. We had a separate Harpenden edition, a separate Radlett edition and a St Albans edition. But even then, they were change pages for Harpenden and Radlett and some of the main paper incorporated into the editions.
So probably now the difference between the Harpenden and the St Albans edition is more a question of choosing a few stories that are more relevant to one place than the other.
Yes, absolutely, and depending very much on what news is happening in and around Harpenden. The Harpenden edition does incorporate Redbourne and Wheat Hampstead, but they're slightly grey areas because some of us feel that perhaps they should be in the main edition as well. So it's a sort of suck-it-and-see exercise.
Where do you get the news from? I mean, you have a whole range. I mean, we select 16 out of probably 30 news stories. Where do you get that many news stories from every week?
Press releases, I suppose, would be the largest source of stories, but they have to be treated fairly carefully. Email, sometimes through the post. We do get tip-offs still. We do get phone calls from people who are unhappy about things. But in the modern age, mostly done electronically these days.
So could you produce this paper from never leaving your office?
Yes, you could. I don't think it would be particularly good, but you could do that.
When you started, presumably, there were more reporters than you have now?
Yeah, when I took over as news editor, we had something in the region of 30 reporters. We were a paid-for paper in those days, and obviously there was much greater staffing levels. That probably was too many, but we've gone very much the other way now, and I've only got 3 reporters.
And those reporters actually do go out to investigate? Do they go and interview people? Or
they do go out occasionally, but to be honest, we're up against it quite a lot every week with the deadline and having to fill the paper. So as much as possible, it's done either through email or telephone conversations. We do go out, but we don't go out anything like as much as we used to.
And you said press, so you get press releases. Those sound like commercial operations coming to you.
Not all of them, but quite a lot of them are. I mean, the charities very regularly send out press releases. Particularly at this time of the year, we are inundated with sponsored events, people doing sponsored events, and the charities often send them out themselves with a photo. But we quite frequently have to get more details. But a lot of them are commercial. I've got one on my desk at the moment, for example, which sounds like a lovely story about a lady who's got scoliosis. But when I looked into it more closely, it's just a plug for a clinic in London, which is a commercial operation. Which is a shame, because it's a lovely story there.
You talked about the old days when your newspaper was had to be bought by somebody before they could read it, and that's changed now. And in fact, there's free delivery in some areas, not where I live. We don't get it free. I have to pay for it. But that mix of the two, has that brought a lot of change to the way that the process works for you?
To begin with, it didn't make a lot of difference. But as the staffing gradually fell, that's where the difference has been felt. I sometimes feel that it's very hard to do the job we used to do. We haven't got the resources to do it. And unfortunately, people still think we've got wall-to-wall reporters and that they phone up in the afternoon and say, I want a reporter in the evening, that somebody can just drop everything and go. And unfortunately, it doesn't work like that anymore.
Because you're not full-time yourself now?
No, I'm 3 days a week, Monday to Wednesday.
And are the other three in your team, are they full-time?
They're full-time.
Oh, they're full-time. How long have you been working with the Hearts Advertiser?
30-plus years. I'm ashamed to admit. I don't think loyalty to a product holds much cadence these days.
Did you go there as news editor?
No, I went there as a reporter. I moved over here because my husband got a job over here and I came in as a reporter and 2 years later I was made news editor. And I've been there ever since. I've had some great editors to work for, and that's had a big part to play in it.
How often do the editors change? I'm not sure how many there have been.
I've worked under four editors. A couple of them were there quite a while. Noel Cantinon, the previous editor, was there the longest, many, many years. And I'm currently working under Matt Adams, who's been with us for about 2 or 3 years now.
How do you decide? Do you decide with Matt on what the principal stories are, or is that entirely your responsibility?
He tends to go along with what I suggest, although he's pretty well aware. A lot of people send emails and things directly to the editor, thinking the editor will write it, which obviously he doesn't, so he passes it on to me. So he's got a pretty good idea of what sort of things are coming through to us, so we can discuss it. But he does tend to give me free rein if I think a particular story is going to be the one for the front.
Because the Hearts Advertiser is non-political, non-party political. Mm. You don't take a position. Whatever, whoever is in power, you will investigate when you can and you will report when you can. Does that ever produce pressures locally? I mean, have you had pressures of a political sort at any time?
We are always accused, always have been, by the various parties of showing a leaning to one of the other parties. It always happens. Because if you write one story criticising, for example, the Conservatives, then they think we're pro-Lib Dem and vice versa, and so it goes on. But we are totally apolitical. The only place we express a view is in the editor's comment, in the leader section. And that's just one person's view. That's not the paper's view. That's just the view of the person who writes it. So we do get tarred with your bias towards brush.
And that's why in many of your main stories, when it's to do with the council, and for instance, the council budget earlier this year, I think, you always try to represent the views of the three principal parties and
we try
often
to.
A Green spokesman as well.
We try to, but we can't always. And sometimes, because of space restrictions, we can't quote everybody who says everything. So we would tend, for example, to usually use the ruling party and whoever is acting as the main opposition on that particular occasion. It just depends, really. It depends what they have to say, how interesting it is, whether they picked up on something new and different.
By virtue of not having a huge number of reporters out there, you can't also necessarily dig behind in the same way the sort of investigative journalism that you might like to do.
No, when I first started at the Hearts Advertiser, we had a designated local council reporter, and he just did local council all the time, and he was always digging under things, and he found a lot of things out. He was very good, but we don't have that luxury anymore, sadly.
How do you handle if there's a pressure group that is particularly key? I mean, I know there are big issues like the Park Street and the Luton Airport and so on, but on other issues, sometimes there may be an allotment story or some development story where there's a group of people who are very much opposed or in favour of something. How do you handle that so you represent both sides of the argument?
Well, we always have to get, I think you've hit the nail on the head, we have to get both sides of the argument. So if, for example, the Sewell Park development, I don't know if you've come across that one, we always try and get a comment from the developers to anything that the Sewell Park campaigners have to say about it. We try always to be balanced. It's not always possible, but we always try. I mean, we have deadlines and people sometimes don't come back before our deadline. But if they don't, we try and do something the following week. We're not perfect, but that's what we try and do.
And it's difficult with an item like the Radlett Airdrome, where you've got so many parties, you've got the government is involved, or through Secretary of State Pickles, you've got the developer, you've got the local residents, you've got all so many people, and yet the story runs, and it's quite difficult to follow that story, isn't it?
Yes, it is a difficult one. It's got a lot of threads to it.
Listening to that and thinking about it, then thinking about what is the purpose of a local paper, the real guts of it. I mean, we have the national papers, we have national broadcasts, we have radio, we have television and everything else. How do you define this Hearts Advertiser in this local society? What do you think you're trying to do?
We are the paper for the people who live on the ground, as it were. The type of news stories that would never appear in a national newspaper but are still vitally important to people who live locally. We pick up on the stuff that would otherwise get overlooked, I think. We are parochial in that respect. We cover a lot of the things, as I said, a lot of things that nobody else will pick up on. But it's an important role, and we get tremendous feedback. Letters page is always full. We've always got plenty of letters. People read the funniest things and respond to them. If we do an appeal for a Finnish speaker, for example, or something like that, we get response from saying, oh, we've had 3 or 4 people phone up and they can speak Finnish and they want to help us. It's amazing what response we get. So it's filling that gap that the national news and broadcasting can't do. And I think it'll go on into the future. I think there'll always be a role for local newspapers. It may be in a different format from now.
We talked about the Hearts Advertiser, and I began to drift off onto what's a local paper for, and we put that in the context of the Hearts Advertiser. But let me just go back to you. You told me that you came to St Albans because your husband got a job here. It's about I forget, 30 years ago or something, and you went to work as a reporter at the Harts Advertiser. Had you been in the newspaper business before?
Yes, I'd been on two previous newspapers. I started my career at the Enfield Gazette, which is where I met my husband, and then I went to the Lee Valley Mercury, and then when we moved out this way, that's when I moved to the Harts Advertiser. At that time, it was relatively easy to get a job in journalism. It's not so easy now, sadly. I think the St Albans Review had started by then. I'm pretty certain it had.
And I remember I think the Review ran quite a big campaign against the shopping centre development that was proposed in, I forget what the scheme was, 30 years ago.
Chequer Street.
Chequer Street.
Yes, that's where I came in, actually, the Chequer Street Action Group and the Chequer Street scene. The editor of the Review at the time was Don Smith, and he was very opposed to the Chequer Street development and the roofed development that Samuels proposed for it. He subsequently became the editor of the Harts Ad, and he was the person who took me on. And so he transferred his commitment to fighting this scheme to the Harts Advertiser. But I think it's true to say the Review made quite a name for itself in its opposition to the Chequer Street scheme.
Listening to that and thinking back to that story, which I'd forgotten because I moved to St Albans about 35 years ago, what are the other things that you remember over that period of time, the big issues, the big stories that ran in the last 30 years?
Well, funnily enough, I think Chequer Street probably was the biggest story in many ways. It became almost a national story. The Chequer Street Action Group, like most St Albans action groups, was incredibly strong, had some very talented and well-connected people involved, and it fought amazingly hard to stop this covered shopping centre being built and supported the eventual scheme was agreed with Bredero, and they supported it. And to this day, of course, it's not a covered shopping centre. So you can say that not only did they win the battle, they won the war as well. There have been attempts since to cover it over, but the council's never given it planning permission. So that's probably the biggest. But there was also a big fuss over the development of what was called Gentle's Yard, which was a rough car park where the Christopher Place shopping centre is now. There was a character called Ginger Mills who used to live in a caravan on there, and Ginger was the focal point of the opposition to the development of Gentle's Yard. It went ahead anyway. It didn't attract the sort of opposition that Chequer Street attracted. And the one that always sticks in my mind is the St Albans one-way system. It was a disaster for anyone who was stuck in it, but still makes me laugh when I think of it today.
Yes, when you look back at these things, you think, how on earth did that happen?
But indeed, particularly with that one. How the County Council could bring the whole of St Albans to a standstill at a cost of £1.5 million was quite beyond me.
I think most of our listeners will remember that.
Yes, I think they will, particularly if they were in a car park trying to get out.
I mean, that's a gift for a reporter, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, occasionally we do get gifts. One or two, perhaps, I want to mention, but we do get gifts, stories that just, you know, fall into your lap. There's nothing you can do but treat them very seriously, but see the funny side of them.
The market seems to be an ongoing story as well. There's always something happening about or in or around the market, I think.
The market is such a fundamental part of St Albans, I think. And the market traders, as a whole, tend to be quite verbal about the market itself and how they feel they're treated. That's nothing new. They always have been. A bit like taxi drivers, they've always got a view on everything. But I think it is important. It draws people in, and the market traders themselves are lovely people, and they fight to preserve it as it is. I think they aren't too happy about new markets coming in and what have you. They want to see the money spent on the existing market, and I don't think they'll ever change, and I can understand why.
Again, this sort of demonstrates the importance of the local paper, doesn't it? Because not all of us know what's going on, obviously. I mean, if we're fortunate enough to be living in the centre, we'll see some of the things. But, I mean, I wouldn't know what was going on at Park Street unless you told me. The Radley Airdrome issue is something that has come to me entirely through the newspaper because we don't know about it. We don't live there, some of us. So the role of the paper is very important.
I think it has an important role in bringing a community together. You know, there is this sort of feeling that if you write about Harpen, then nobody in St Albans is interested and vice versa. But I don't really go along with that. I think it is a district and I think there is a big overlap. And I think it does bring the community together. People do talk about things that are happening in other parts of the St Albans district, which is important.
What would you say was the biggest challenge to local print media?
Well, it will be tablets and websites and what have you. It is already to a degree, but it's something I think we won't feel during my time. The next generation, I think, will probably read papers on tablets and mobile phones and what have you. What impact that will have on news coverage, I don't know. There is a perceived wisdom that people reading stories on websites haven't got the same patience as they have reading it on sitting on a settee with a cup of coffee, reading a print edition. So there could be a huge number of changes. It's almost hard to say. But I think probably newspaper companies will never do as well as they did in the peak of the print days when they were packed with advertising. That era's gone and that's not going to come back. And they're trying to tackle that, but I'm not sure how far they're getting really.
So it may be that we have to accept that, just as in so many ways, that we're sort of in a snippet world. You know, we take small doses,
sound bites.
Yeah. And so we will do that with the news. We'll get a sense of what the story is about. We won't go into the depth of it.
I think so. But what that will do for local journalism, I'm not sure. Try not to think about it too much, because I'm very defensive of local journalism. I think it's got a really important role, to an investigative role, as and when you can do it. And I'm not sure that will still be there in the future.
Because there have been times in the past, in not in this area, but I'm thinking of other areas, sometimes in the northeast and elsewhere, where there's actually corruption at a local level, which the local newspaper would have been critical to uncovering and revealing. You need the investigative journalist to do that, and that's what you're saying already, that it's quite difficult to do that within the resources you have.
I think it is actually, but they do. I mean, anybody, any authority needs somebody to keep an eye on what they're doing, I think, and they know we do. And they often argue with us and say, oh, no, you don't want to cover this angle, you don't want to do this. But we do, because there's something more to things than meets the eye. And we can still do that to a degree, but I'm not sure in the future to what degree that will happen. I mean, a lot of papers now are very much just leaflets covering press releases as they come in. We, as a point of principle, don't cover press releases as they come in. We always change them.
The other thing that's potentially challenging the news media generally is this Leveson inquiry and the whole issue that came around the hacking into phones and so on. Do you see that as going to be having much effect upon local newspapers? Because you're not caught up in the hacking issue at all, but you might be caught up in the fallout from what is decided for how the regulations will...
We are regulated, like the National Press, already by Press Complaints Commission, or we were. I think it's now defunct. I'm not quite sure where it is. So we do get referred there and we have to respond. And it's always worked well for us. But what will happen, particularly if there's some kind of legal requirement, I don't know. But during the Leveson report, I think it was made quite clear that this did not affect local papers. In fact, I think they were quite complimentary about local papers. So we shouldn't feel too much from it, I hope. But I think people are aware of it, and they quite frequently expect payment for anything they give us, which we can't do. And they're
because they've sensed that at a national level,
yes,
journalists will pay for information.
Yes.
You find even at a local level that people are expecting some form of payment.
Quite often, and more so now than ever before. Now, whether that's to do with Leveson or just the way society is going, I'm not absolutely certain, but they do. And also they're very, very careful about how they respond to us these days. The local authorities, fire service, ambulance, you name it, they've got a press officer who will respond by email, and that's very limiting as well. And I think it's just to make sure that they've covered themselves, that they haven't said anything to the press that could be misunderstood or misconstrued.
Because that can be changed. Whereas in the old days, if you go back to the old Smokey Joe investigative journalist, been out there getting a bit of information here, and you can't do that quite
you
so
would,
easily.
Yes, I mean, when I first started, you would ring the county council, for example, who had one press officer. They've now got about... Well, at one stage, they had about 20. They haven't so many now. But you would then be put through to the officer who was dealing with an issue. You'd chat to him or her. They would say something and that would trigger another question. And then you could get a lot of information from that. That's gone completely. Now, even for something fairly routine, you have to go via the press officer. And the press officer invariably wants to respond by email. So it's there in black and white and they can say, this is what we told you. So everyone covers their backs these days, and possibly that is in the wake of Leveson, but I think it's been more and more so in recent years anyway.
A lot of challenges there for a local paper, but we hope you manage to rise to all of them and to keep going, because we depend upon you. Our listeners depend upon you producing a paper every week.
I think we'll do our best.
Thank you very much for your time, Madeleine. Thanks for coming in.
Next from our Talking Bookshelf series, here's a discussion I had with Isabel Martin of the Hearts Library Service about two audiobooks. Welcome back to Isabella Martin, who's a librarian with Hertfordshire Library Service, and it's with me this afternoon to talk about audiobooks that you might like to choose from the library or online and listen to in the weeks ahead. So Isabella, let's talk about your selection, The Cuckoo's Calling, which is written by a chap, supposedly, called Robert Galbraith. But all was revealed, wasn't it, last year? Tell us about it.
So this was published in April 2013 by Robert Galbraith, but the Sunday Times actually uncovered in July 2013, but it was in fact published by J.K. Rowling of Harry Potter fame. So, and actually it had got good reviews and was coming along quite nicely. It was emerging quite nicely as a title before J.K. Rowling was rumbled. I think it was a shame for her, as she'd obviously chosen to have a nom de plume, and she was quite enjoying not having the pressure of it being a J.K. Rowling title and seeing how it went along. And to be rumbled quite so quickly when she's sort of talking about this being a 6 books plus series, I think was quite disappointing for her.
Yes, but it has done very well.
And it done very well.
I think there is now a second book in the series.
There's a second title out, yes, The Silkworm.
So if you like this one, The Cuckoo's Calling, then there is more to be had. So this is a crime novel.
Yes, it's quite a classic detective story. It's got a private detective called Cormoran Strike, who is not probably what you'd expect of a detective. He's ex-military police. Unfortunately, he's had an accident in Afghanistan and has lost one leg, and he's quite down on his luck at the beginning of his novel. His long-term partner, his fiance, has just left him after he uncovered a series of lies. He's in quite severe debt from setting up this private detective agency and is having to sleep in his office, and it's all not going great for him. He's got a number of clients who have chosen not to pay bills because they haven't liked what he's uncovered, and he's pretty much at his lowest ebb. And then John Bristow comes into his office with a case, and that's where we start. And to start with, Cormoran doesn't really want to take this case. He thinks it's a very publicised case of a suicide of a model, John's sister, adoptive sister. And he thinks actually, with the publicity, the police would have gone over it with a fine tooth comb and almost sees John as delusional. But when John offers to pay him double, he can't help but think it wouldn't hurt to start to look into it.
And then he also, in the office with his camp bed, he gets a temporary assistant.
Yes, that was the other thing of his bad day. He'd cancelled his contract with his temp, thinking he can't afford an office temp anymore. And lo and behold, who walks through the door but another temp? So Robin gets introduced, and Robin has always secretly wanted to work for a private detective agency. So she's quite excited about it, to find Cormoran, who's not really in the best of moods and doesn't want a temp. And this very day that John then walks into the office. So Cormoran starts by thinking, OK, I'll have to pay her a week. I can just about afford to pay her a week. But then Robin proves herself to be the best temp he's ever had.
Quite an asset in the end.
A very big asset.
So what persuades him that this case, the suicide, well, the apparent suicide of this model Lula, what makes him change his mind and decide that there is something to be investigated?
As he started looking into it, there were a couple of things in the case that just didn't quite add up. The police discount a bit of evidence because of the evidence as it presented couldn't be true. But Cormoran questions if it's actually the fact that the witness was not where the witness claimed to be that made the evidence. So the evidence she was presenting was true, but maybe not quite how she was telling it. And then that opened up a whole new can of worms as to, okay, so if this was true, then it's said to sort of stack of dominoes. He goes about and he interviews pretty much everyone who was part of Lula's life. It takes a lot of phone calls by Robin to get him into some of these doors, because there's fashion designers and film producers, as Lula was one of the number one models. She was well loved and definitely a celebrity. So to try and open some of these doors to find out what had happened to Lula was really difficult, but he manages to get his toe in eventually.
Well, the setting must be quite real for somebody like J.K. Rowling, who of course, you know, has been on film sets galore, hasn't she, with her own novel. So they must ring quite true.
There's been commentary that she's almost written what she knows with the Cormoran Strike series, because of this one is almost focusing on the celebrity and almost the sort of the over-the-top nature of the paparazzi and the celebrity, and sort of being pushed to the edge, drawn from what she knows.
That's no bad thing.
No bad thing.
No, no. And what's the relationship that Cormoran Strike has with the police? Because no doubt he's sort of up against them, having done the done the investigation.
As he is ex-military police, he actually has quite a number of contacts. He knows people who've gone from military police to the Metropolitan Police. So he thankfully has an in who manages to set him up with getting in touch with the lead investigator on the case. And then he manages to, through another contact, be able to find out a bit of information the police didn't know on an active case. So manages to get his way in by saying, well, I know this, I can give you this if you will give me the file. So he manages to get his toe in the door that way. As the case then goes on, the shut case with Lula Landry, unfortunately, then almost has to come open again. And the police are not so pleased with him by that point. And then this sort of more rocky relationship with the police does continue into Silkworm.
It does feel quite authentic, does it?
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed this. And especially, it's set in London, it's set in central London. And some of the descriptions of London around Tottenham Court Road, which is an area I know quite well, the air of authenticity of what she's describing and where these places are really does ring true.
And do the characters ring true for you too?
Yes. I mean, I'm a massive J.K. Rowling fan. I grew up loving Harry Potter. And I think she really does get characters, and she has real proper characters. They have lives, and they have their own existence almost, and they have their secrets, and they develop. And with this being a series, I have read the second one, and the characters do continue to develop, and there's things that are alluded to in the characters that you still haven't heard about.
So just to recap, it's called The Cuckoo's Calling. It's by Robert Galbraith, but it's really by J.K. Rowling. And it's read by, we haven't mentioned.
It's read by Robert Glenister.
OK, so you've described for us the arrival of Robin, the new temp, who thankfully is quite efficient. And you've chosen an extract from the audio book about this stage of the novel.
Yes, so it's Robin's first day. And she has literally just got into the office. Strike's not really wanting her there. And then a client arrives. So Strike hasn't given her any instruction or anything at all. Robin's offered to make them tea and coffee and found out there's no tea, there's no coffee, there's no mugs. So has popped downstairs to borrow some and has gone into the inner office to deliver this to Strike and the client. And then Strike gives her an instruction.
Robin laid out two cups, a milk jug, a sugar bowl and a plate of chocolate biscuits, none of which Strike had ever seen before, smiled in perfunctory fashion at his thanks and made to leave.
"Hang on a moment, Sandra," said Strike. "Could you..."
He took a piece of paper from his desk and slid it onto his knee. While Bristow made soft gulping noises, Strike wrote very swiftly and as legibly as he could manage, "Please Google Lula Landry and find out whether she was adopted, and if so, by whom. Do not discuss what you were doing with the woman outside. What is she doing here? Write down the answers to questions above and bring them to me here without saying what you found." He handed the piece of paper to Robin, who took it wordlessly and left the room.
"Sorry. I'm so sorry,"
Bristow gasped when the door had closed.
"This is... I'm not usually... I've been back at work, seeing clients."
He took several deep breaths. With his pink eyes, the resemblance to an albino rabbit was heightened. His right knee was still jiggling up and down.
"It's just been a dreadful time,"
he whispered, taking deep breaths.
"Lula, and my mother's dying."
Strike's mouth was watering at the sight of the chocolate biscuits, because he had eaten nothing for what felt like days. But he felt it would strike an unsympathetic note to start snacking while Bristow jiggled and sniffed and mopped his eyes. The pneumatic drill was still hammering like a machine gun down in the street.
"She's given up completely since Lula died. It's broken her. Her cancer was supposed to be in remission, but it's come back, and they say there's nothing more they can do. I mean, this is the second time. She had a sort of breakdown after Charlie. My father thought another child would make it better. They'd always wanted a girl. It wasn't easy for them to be approved, but Lula was mixed race and harder to place, so..." He finished on a strangled sob. "They managed to get her. She was always beautiful. She was discovered in Oxford Street, out shopping with my mother, taken on by Athena. It's one of the most prestigious agencies. She was modelling full-time by 17. By the time she died, she was worth around 10 million. I don't know why I'm telling you all this. You probably know it all. Everyone knew. Thought they knew. All about Lula.
He picked up his cup clumsily. His hands were trembling so much that coffee slopped over the edge onto his sharply pressed suit trousers.
"What exactly is it that you would like me to do for you?" Strike asked.
Bristow replaced the cup shakily on the desk, then gripped his hands together tightly. "They say my sister killed herself. I don't believe it."
Strike remembered the television pictures. The black body bag on a stretcher, flickering in a storm of camera flashes as it was loaded into an ambulance. The photographers clustering around as it started to move, holding up their cameras to the dark windows, white lights bouncing off the black glass. He knew more about the death of Lula Landry than he had ever meant or wanted to know. The same would be true of virtually any sentient being in Britain. Bombarded with the story, you grew interested against your will, and before you knew it, you were so well informed, so opinionated about the facts of the case, you would have been unfit to sit on a jury.
There was an inquest, wasn't there?
Yes, but the detective in charge of the case was convinced from the outset that it was suicide, purely because Lula was on lithium. The things he overlooked, they've even spotted some of them on the internet.
Bristow jabbed a nonsensical finger at Strike's bare desktop, where a computer might have been expected to stand. A perfunctory knock and the door opened. Robin strode in, handed Strike a folded note and withdrew.
"Sorry, do you mind?" said Strike. "I've been waiting for this message."
He unfolded the note against his knee so that Bristow could not see through the back and read, "Lula Landry was adopted by Sir Alec and Lady Yvette Bristow when she was 4. She grew up as Lula Bristow but took her mother's maiden name when she started modelling. She has an older brother called John who is a lawyer. The girl waiting outside is Mr. Bristow's girlfriend and a secretary at his firm. They work for Landry, May, Patterson, the firm started by Lula and John's maternal grandfather. The photograph of John Bristow on LMP's homepage is identical to the man you're talking to."
Strike crumpled the note and dropped it into the waste paper basket at his feet.
He was staggered. John Bristow was not a fantasist, and he, Strike, appeared to have been sent a temp with more initiative and better punctuation than any he had ever met.
So that's a crime novel. We now move on to something, a book that is much more of a classic, and you've chosen To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee, which was first published in 1960 and has become a staple, hasn't it, on the school curriculum? And
well, I did it at school originally. It was a staple for my GCSEs. And then I actually returned and read it 3 or 4 years ago. And I really enjoyed going back to it. And again, sort of 3 years on, I've loved listening to it.
And it centres around a lawyer called Atticus Finch and his 2 children, Scout and Jem, her brother.
Yes.
It's told from Scout's perspective all the time, though, isn't
it? It's all from Scout's point of view. So it's narrated by 8-year-old Scout, but it's a story set over 2 years, so you start off with 6-year-old Scout. And I believe it's a really clever decision of Harper Lee, as you have all that childhood innocence and you get to sort of see the world through Scout's eyes, and a lot of it's the adult world that she's observing, and she's having to be drawn into. Her father is a lawyer and is defending a black man accused of raping a white female. And
we should say it's set in 1933 start with. So right in the midst of the Great Depression in Alabama, a fictional town in Alabama.
And therefore, there's a lot of feeling amongst the town that her father should not be doing this. And the feeling is being made quite clear to the children. It's, I mean, the main themes of the novel are sort of equality and prejudice.
Yes.
And I think seeing it through the eyes of Scout is very clever. And you also get the humour from seeing it through the eyes of Scout. I mean, the thing that always tickles me is her brother, when Scout goes to school, her brother is convinced that the method of teaching is called the Dewey Decimal System. So as a librarian, the Dewey Decimal System is how we order our non-fiction books. But Jem is convinced that this is their method. They've got a new method of teaching, that they're not allowed to write and they're not allowed to read until quite high, until a few years of schooling. They've got to go out and learn and do. And Jem tells Scout this is the Dewey Decimal System. So to Scout, this is the Dewey Decimal System. And there's other elements of humour that you get through that as well.
It's a lovely relationship between the two children, isn't it?
Yeah.
Jem and Scout. And actually, there are various little subplots as well, because they get quite obsessed, really, with this man who's quite a recluse, who lives nearby, who's called Boo Radley.
Yes. So this is almost sort of what the first part of a novel sort of concentrates on before it then moves on to the trial of Tom Robinson, this black man. And it introduces these whole ideas of equality and prejudice, because the town paints Boo Radley as this almost spectre figure. He doesn't come out of his house. There's stories about how he stabbed his father with a pair of scissors, and there's this sort of almost mystique about him, but the children won't walk past the Radley house. They run past the Radley house, and they will just avoid it until Dill comes to town one summer. And Dill, their new friend, is really intrigued by the Radley and the whole story. And the extract I chose, he actually wants to go and deliver a letter to Boo. And Scout's not sure this is a good idea.
So let's hear that extract now.
Next morning when I awakened, I found Jem and Dill in the backyard, deep in conversation. When I joined them, as usual, they said, "Go away." "Will not. This yard's as much mine as it is yours, Jem Finch. I got just as much right to play in it as you have." Dill and Jem emerged from a brief huddle. "If you stay, you've got to do what we tell you," Dill warned. "Well," I said, "who's so high and mighty all of a sudden? If you don't say you'll do what we tell you, we ain't going to tell you anything," Dill continued. "You act like you grew 10 inches in the night." "All right, what is it?" Jem said placidly, "We are going to give a note to Boo Radley." "Just how?" I was trying to fight down the automatic terror rising in me. It was all right for Miss Maudie to talk. She was old and snug on her porch. It was different for us. Jem was merely going to put the note on the end of a fishing pole and stick it through the shutters. If anyone came along, Dill would ring the bell. Dill raised his right hand. In it was my mother's silver dinner bell. "I'm going around to the side of the house," said Jem. "We looked yesterday from across the street, and there's a shutter loose. Think maybe I can make it stick on the windowsill at least." "Jem, now you're in it and you can't get out of it. You'll just stay in it, Miss Pris." "Okay, okay, but I don't want to watch." "Jem, somebody was..." "Yes, you will. You'll watch the back end of the lot, and Dill's going to watch the front of the house and up the street, and if anybody comes, he'll ring the bell. That clear?" "All right, then. What'd you write him?" Dill said, "We're asking him real politely to come out sometimes and tell us what he does in there." We said we wouldn't hurt him, and we'd buy him an ice cream. "You all have gone crazy. He'll kill us." Dill said, "It's my idea. I figure if he'd come out and sit a spell with us, he might feel better."
So you have this sort of lovely rapport between the children, and you very much get the sense of their daily routine. But of course, behind that daily routine of school and their relationship with their father is this highly moral tale of racial prejudice, isn't it? Which is so powerful.
Yeah, it's really powerful. But I think it works so well because, as you say, it's amongst this tale of childhood and going to school. So there is this really powerful message. I mean, the title comes from Atticus saying to Jem, "Shoot all the blue jays you want if you can hit them. But remember, it's a sin to kill a mockingbird." And Harper Lee almost sets up two mockingbirds in this tale. So you have the Boo Radley of the first part and how he's been alienated by the village and been seen as this sort of spectre figure and sort of looking at him. And then you move on to focus on Tom Robinson as sort of the other Mockingbird set up in this novel.
And there's a real sense of menace about the prejudices that exist within the townspeople and how not only destructive they are, but actually how threatening they are.
Mm. But equally, Harper Lee is very keen to kind of say, OK, there is this prejudice, but there's a beautiful quote about you'll never understand someone until you've walked around in their shoes, which is another something that Atticus is saying to his children. So it's saying, OK, so there is this prejudice, but actually take a step back and see it from their point of view. There's a character, Mrs. DeBose, who appears to be just a horrible, horrible old lady. She almost terrorises the children. And then it's almost a flipped round when you get to sort of understand the whole of her. Again, it's very cleverly constructed.
It has been said that there is a sort of autobiographical element to Harper Lee's writing. Did you get that sense?
Not until I researched it more. It's one of those things that, I mean, I first read it as a novel, so took it as a novel. But when you start to look into it, she grew up in a community sort of the same sort of size in the deep south of America. Her father was a lawyer. So I think this has often been quite a common theme we've been talking about. She has drawn from what she knows, which is where great literature often comes from.
She never wrote anything else,
no.
Did she? Which is strange, but such a powerful book. It's one of those books that does not date.
No, it does not date. And I think there are messages in the novel which we can still take and are still just as current now as it was 54 years ago when it was published.
So the title again is To Kill a Mockingbird. It's written by Harper Lee. And who's reading it on this audiobook?
This one's read by Sissy Speck.
Next morning when I awakened, I found Jim and Dill in the backyard deep in conversation. When I joined them, as usual, they said, go away. Will not. This yard's as much mine as it is yours, Jim Finch. I got just as much right to play in it as you have. Dill and Jim emerged from a brief huddle. If you stay, you've got to do what we tell you, Dill warned. Well, I said, who's so high and mighty all of a sudden? If you don't say you'll do what we tell you, we ain't going to tell you anything, Dill continued. You act like you grew 10 inches in the night. All right, what is it? Jim said placidly, we are going to give a note to Boo Radley. Just how? I was trying to fight down the automatic terror rising in me. It was all right for Miss Maudie to talk. She was old and snug on her porch. It was different for us. Jim was merely going to put the note on the end of a fishing pole and stick it through the shutters. If anyone came along, Dill would ring the bell. Dill raised his right hand. In it was my mother's silver dinner bell. I'm going around to the side of the house, said Jim. We looked yesterday from across the street and there's a shutter loose. Think maybe I can make it stick on the windowsill at least. Jim, now you're in it and you can't get out of it. You'll just stay in it, Miss Pris. Okay, okay, but I don't want to watch. Jim, somebody was... Yes, you will. You'll watch the back end of the lot and Dill's going to watch the front of the house and up the street and if anybody comes, he'll ring the bell. That clear? All right, then. What'd you write him? Dill said, we're asking him real politely to come out sometimes and tell us what he does in there. We said we wouldn't hurt him, and we'd buy him an ice cream. You all have gone crazy. He'll kill us. Dill said, it's my idea. I figure if he'd come out and sit a spell with us, he might feel better.
Isabella Martin, thank you very much indeed for coming in. And I know you're coming back again at a later date to recommend more audiobooks.
Thank you for having me.
Now our selection of national radio programmes that you might like to listen to this coming week. It's compiled and read by David Thompson.
Hello, I'm David, and I'm bringing you some radio highlights for this coming week. that I hope you will enjoy listening to in the days ahead. First of all, Saturday the 4th of July. Today's vintage comedy is Brothers-in-Law, a legal sitcom from 1970, starring Richard Briers and John Lemessurier. On Radio 4 Extra at 9:30 a.m., repeated at 2:30 p.m. and 8:30 p.m. Radio 3's Essential History of Classical Music explores Johann Sebastian Bach's The Well-Tempered Clavier on Radio 3 at 1 p.m. And Radio 2 brings you Madonna and Graham, where Graham Norton and Madonna have an intimate and in-depth chat. And that's on Radio 2 at 6 p.m. Opera on 3 today is Bizet's Les Pêcheurs de Perles, or The Pearl Fishers. And you'll find that on Radio 3 at 6 p.m. And we couldn't pass over the 4th of July without something American. James Naughtie looks at how Americans celebrate the anniversary of the Declaration of Independence in Archive on 4, Born on the 4th of July, and that's on Radio 4 at 8 p.m. And Radio 4 brings you a comedy set in an Ulster parish council meeting. In Parish Matters, Don't Come Crying to Me When the Robots Take Over. And that's on Radio 4 at 11 p.m. And then for Sunday, the 5th of July, Sunday worship this morning comes from Hereford Cathedral on Radio 4 at 8:10 in the morning. Classic comedy today is a 1955 episode of Take It From Here, on Radio 4 Extra at 10:30 a.m, repeated at 3 p.m. and 9:30 p.m. Lauren Laverne's guest on Desert Island Discs today is the glaciologist Professor Liz Morris, and you can find that on Radio 4 at 10 a.m, repeated on Friday at 9 a.m. Radio 4 brings you the 1921 American play Anna Christie by Eugene O'Neill, and that's on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. And Desert Island Discs Revisited, Dame Ellen MacArthur talks to Kirsty Young about her solo circumnavigation of the globe, and that's on Radio 4 Extra at 5 p.m. And a further musical celebration of American independence is the Sunday feature A Musical Evening at Monticello, on Radio 3 at 7 p.m. In Later Life Letter, poet Luke Wright considers the letters written by social workers telling adopted children about their birth families, including his own experiences. And that's on Radio 4 at 7:15 p.m. And now for some programmes that are broadcast each weekday at the same time. Book of the Week this week is On Thin Ice, a memoir of Siberia, surveillance and survival by explorer and travel writer Charlie Walker. And that's on Radio 4 each day at 11:45 a.m. And then episodes 6 to 10 of 10 Fights That Made the Green Movement is on Radio 4 each day at 1:45 p.m. Radio 3's Composer of the Week this week is Fela Saunedi, the late Nigerian composer. And that's on Radio 3 each afternoon at 4 p.m. The essay Call of the Wild is on Radio 3 at 9:45 each evening. Operation Rex is a story of one boy's challenges that he faced in keeping his pet at the beginning of the Second World War. And that's on Radio 4 each evening at 10:45 p.m. Then Monday, the 6th of July, today's vintage comedy is a 1976 episode of Dad's Army. Radio 4 Extra at 7:30 a.m, repeated 12:30 p.m. and 6:30 p.m. In Reflections, James Naughtie talks to Jerry Brown, the former governor of California, on Radio 4 at 9:30 a.m. Classical Live on Radio 3 shines the spotlight on orchestras due to appear in this year's proms. Classical Live is on Radio 3 at 1 p.m. Radio 4 addresses the problem of artificial intelligence being used by students in place of building their argument in essays in the Artificial University on Radio 4 at 4 p.m. And Radio 3 in concert today brings you Bach's Mass in B minor with the BBC Singers on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. Tuesday the 7th of July. A 1958 episode of The Goon Show is today's vintage comedy. Radio 4 Extra at 7:30 a.m. repeated at 12:30 and 6:30 p.m. People Fixing the World is a programme about helping aspiring entrepreneurs to bring their ideas to life. And that's on the BBC World Service at 8:05 in the morning, repeated at 3:05 and 10:05 this afternoon and this evening. The Art of Isolation, Hikikomori Stories, exploring the world of socially isolated people on Radio 4 at 4 p.m. Radio 3 in concert today is a performance of Mahler's epic Resurrection Symphony, and that's on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. To Catch a King follows an investigation into catching people smugglers on Radio 4 at 9 p.m. Wednesday the 8th of July, Hancock's Half Hour is today's vintage comedy from 1955, Radio 4 Extra at 7:30 a.m, 12:30 and 6:30 p.m. The Odyssey, a dramatisation of Homer's epic tale, is on Radio 4 Extra at 2:30 p.m. and 8:30 p.m. Choral Evensong on Radio 3 comes from the Parish Church of St John at Hampstead in London, and you can find that on Radio 3 at 3 p.m. Radio 3 in concert tonight brings you a recorded performance of Monteverdi's Vespers of 1610, and that's on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. And then Thursday, the 9th of July, I'm Sorry, I'll Read That Again brings you a 1965 comedy episode at 7:30 a.m. and 12:30 and 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra. Who Do You Think We Were? National Remembrance of the 1924 Empire Exhibition, a series marking the 75th anniversary of the 1951 Festival of Britain, on Radio 4 at 9 a.m. In a new series of This Natural Life, Dame Judy Dench takes you on a tour of her woodland garden in Surrey, on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. And Radio 3 in concert this evening comes from York Minster, in a concert devoted to Spanish choral music from the Renaissance. That's on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. And then Friday the 10th of July. Today's vintage comedy is a 1976 episode of Steptoe and Son. Radio 4 Extra at 7:30 a.m, 12:30 and 6:30 p.m. And Desert Island Discs today brings you a repeat of last Sunday's episode with Professor Liz Morris on Radio 4 at 9 a.m. Heart and Soul brings you the account of a Japanese man who lost his wife in the 2011 tsunami and who dives into the waters of Onagawa Bay twice a day in tribute to her. Heart and Soul is on BBC World Service at 1:30 p.m., repeated at 10:30 p.m. Limelight Central Intelligence is a drama about the CIA in 1964, as President Johnson fears that the communists might win the elections in Chile. Limelight Central Intelligence is on Radio 4 at 2:15 p.m. Friday night is Music Night, brings you a concert celebrating 75 years of the iconic BBC drama The Archers. and that's on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. And that concludes my selection for this week. I do hope you have found it both helpful and entertaining.
Next, here's an interview from our Me and My Job series, in which Rob Pearman talks to BBC television journalist and news presenter Martine Croxall.
Martine Croxall is a journalist and one of the main news presenters on BBC Television News. And I'm going to embarrass her, she doesn't know this yet, by quoting from something written by CBS Network news correspondent David Henderson. And he was talking about Martine's handling of the Paris attacks in 2015. And I'll just read a little bit of it. Despite the unspeakable carnage and utter chaos across central Paris, a no-nonsense BBC World News presenter brought level-headed clarity to the attacks and horror in Paris with an understated professional style that was a reflection, I believe, of television's great news anchors like Walter Cronkite, Peter Jennings and Dan Rather. Her name is Martine Croxall. Now, she knows where that comes from.
I do know where it came from, yes. Yeah, and it was extremely flattering.
It's a lovely piece.
It's lovely. I know.
It's great.
Oh, gosh, to be compared to Peter Jennings and Walter Cronkite. Yeah. I know. Well, Peter Jennings was my favourite from ABC News, who died not so long ago. Yeah. No, it was a lovely thing to write. He wrote to me, actually, on the night and said, I've been watching you. And he started asking me questions like, when are you normally on? And I was thinking, why is that? And then he sent me a link, and I thought, good grief. Go.
Martine, you started, I'm not talking about starting life, although I know that was in Leicestershire.
It was.
Presumably you were educated there as well.
I was educated partly in Leicestershire and also over the border in Warwickshire.
Okay.
Yeah.
But then you went off to university in Leeds.
I did.
To study geography, which is, it's a sort of great indeterminate title. What does geography mean?
It is. Yeah, well, it means, depends which kind of course you're doing. But I'm going to champion geography for just one
absolutely,
minute, Rob, if you don't
mind.
Because
you are a member of the Institute.
I'm a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society, right. And I'm very fortunate to host events for them sometimes at their headquarters, which is just on Kensington Gore near Imperial College in London. Geographers have the best employment rate after graduation of all degrees. So, because it's recognised as being a very good analytical degree, a bit like history. History comes up for a close second. But yeah, geography is in demand from employers. I use mine all the time and it informs the interviews that I do, I think, sort of spatially and geographically.
Right. So it doesn't matter that you could say, well, actually, it's not conditioning you to go into any particular route. You could go anywhere from geography.
Yes, and people did. I mean, the people I was at university with went into all sorts of things. Accountancy, production management, environment agency, which is obviously an obvious one. But it's a massive subject that different degree courses in different universities will cover in very different ways.
So why did you go into communication?
It's a very good question. I wanted to be a vet until I was about 15. I think I'd watched too much All Creatures Great and Small. But then I realised that I probably could have done the right A-levels, but it would have been a stretch for me. And the things that I really enjoyed doing were the humanities. And I actually liked producing things, making things, creative, not necessarily in a, you know, I'd like to paint pictures sort of way, although I do that, as it turns out, but not well enough to make a living from. I like projects. I like creating things. And I just thought, well, how could I do that? And I thought, well, writing, journalism, radio. And I just decided that that's the way I was going to try. And I was very fortunate.
Had you done any of that at school or university?
I'd written a bit for the student newspaper at Leeds, but it wasn't print journalism that I particularly wanted to do. I liked the idea of making radio programmes. And my idea was that I wanted to be a magazine programme producer. And I very much wanted to be behind the scenes. I was kind of confident on a one-to-one basis, but in my teens, I was the girl who would blush crimson if you asked me anything. And so a lot of my contemporaries from school are very surprised that I now am reading the news on national television, but I'm no longer 14 years of age and I've got a bit more confidence. But I didn't intend to be on air at all. And it was only one day when I had rung Radio Leicester, which was my local radio station in the Midlands, close to where my parents live. And I just said, look, I've just come back from travelling abroad. I'd like to come and see what you do. I'd like to consider a career in radio. Fortunately, the station manager said, yeah, come in. And I walked into the newsroom. It seemed like bedlam to me, people running around with tape recorders, filing things for the news. And I just thought, how does everybody know what they're doing? But they all seemed to. And there was a real buzz in there. And it was immensely exciting. And I was put with a magazine programme. It was partly a phone-in programme. And I literally started making the tea answering the phones, showing guests in and out, bits of filing. It was the most basic beginning you could have had. And as a result of that, I understood where I fitted in to the greater scheme of things in the BBC. And it was a very good place to start. And there were lots of opportunities because budgets are always tight in local radio. So you get a chance to do things quite quickly. If you've got an idea, they want to get it on air. And one day, the producer of the programme I was working on said, "You've got to go out and do an interview live." And I said, "I don't want to do that. I didn't come here to be on air." "Well, there's no one else to do it, so you'll have to be you." And they sent me down to the centre of Leicester. And if anybody knows the city, there's a clock tower, which is a bit of a sort of a location where everybody knows it, a meeting point for people. And I'd got to interview two people about the launch of a charity fundraising effort to build the National Forest, plant the National Forest in Leicestershire, Staffordshire and Derbyshire. One of the people was dressed as a tree in a rubber costume, which was quite a challenge because it's difficult to hear him. But I did it, and I seemed to have a bit of a knack for just talking and describing and being the eyes of the listener, being conversational. And it just took off from there. And then they trained me to use the radio car. My career was a little bit back to front. Most people start doing recorded pieces rather than live. And I did it the other way around. And I spent 6 months travelling around Leicestershire and Rutland doing live reporting, which was the best grounding because you're having to think on your feet. You're making programmes on a shoestring.
But you still on the work experience, or was this are you now being paid by them to
I got
this?
Paid, eventually, I got paid for some clerical work that I did. That was the first bit of... I think I worked for 6 weeks without earning any money. I'm very understanding parents. And then Radio Leicester seemed to think I'd got some ability, so they sent me on training courses to London. And slowly, I built up a set of skills that were actually useful to the station, so they would pay me for making packages and doing interviews, going out gathering material. And I think I used to earn about £15 a day to begin with. And then we had a pay rise and it was £25 a day, which felt like you'd won, you know, the lottery. But this was before the National Lottery even existed. But then I got a contract and then a staff job, and I followed a path through the BBC, which is quite well set out for you to sort of navigate. We have this system called attachments, where you're seconded. You apply for it as if it's a job, and then you go for 3 months, 6 months, 12 months to a new department. You learn new skills, and then you go back to your home post, assuming they haven't got a job to give you. And so it's a way of working your way around the BBC quite safely.
So it's an employer which actually looks after its staff, sees the opportunities and wants people to find their own opportunities. Is that the way it works?
Yes, and there are a lot of people I work with at New Broadcasting House, sort of the main London office of the BBC, who started in local radio and followed various paths. The obvious one is the one I did, which was to go to regional television and then to national television or to national radio. So it's very well trodden.
Where did you go from Leicester?
I went to Nottingham. To work for East Midlands Today, where I did one of these attachments to learn about TV, because it's so different from radio. I'd got used to thinking in sound and then found it very difficult to think in pictures, because if you can't show it, you can't really say it. You know, you need to write to your pictures. So I found that quite a gear change. But then I got myself together a little showreel of all the things that I'd done while I was there for about 4 months. And that got me my next job, which is why I came to live in Hertfordshire. Because I went to work at BBC Elstree as a broadcast journalist. So you were doing a bit of everything.
What was the BBC Elstree there?
That was Newsroom South East, which is now BBC London. So that was in 1997. And I had three very busy years there reporting on London and the South East. And I didn't really know the patch particularly well at the beginning, but I certainly did by the end.
So you moved out of radio now, and you were fully in television.
Yes, did bits of radio, because we used to have this sort of bi-media system where you would contribute to radio as well. But I was very fortunate that I got there, and I'd only been there about a week or 10 days. I think it was my seventh or eighth shift. And I had a phone call one night from a colleague. She said, "You're on in the morning." I said, "Yes, I know. I'm producing the breakfast TV bulletin." She went, "No, you're reading them." And I said, "Are you sure?" She said, "Yes, someone's gone sick. You did a screen test. They were happy with it. You're on." Well, I was terrified, you know. And I know people who watched my first bulletin go out and they still remind me of how startled I looked. But, you know, I did it. I talked to time. I didn't disgrace myself or let anybody down. So they let me carry on.
And now you are well and truly established in BBC television news. But you've in fact covered, I mean, there's what the main sort of BBC One news, but then there's the BBC World News. And it's a bit confusing sometimes to work out because I keep switching between channels with the news because there's a lot of things going on.
Yes, well, you can't watch BBC World News in this country, but I did work for that channel for about 10 years, which was a fantastic experience because the international news agenda and the way you do interviews and it is very different from the domestic one. But I work for the BBC News channel, which for a long time was called BBC News 24. Then at times of the day, 1 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 10 o'clock, the big national network bulletins appear on our channel as well as on BBC One. And so you'd see the same thing. The two channels come together at various times of day for those big built bulletins. But the channel I work for is on air 24 hours a day in some form or another.
And how many hours are you on call at a time? Is it
my shift?
It's not 24 hours, obviously.
No, thankfully they do have a few other people to rely upon. My usual time slot is evenings towards the end of the week and over the weekend. So I go on air at either 6:30 or 7 o'clock and I'm on air until just before midnight. We do have some breaks where sport take over or there's a pre-recorded programme or we hand to the 10 o'clock news. Or BBC World might do some of the output for us, but I can be on air for 5 hours. If a big story breaks, as it did when the London riots happened quite a few years ago now, I was on air for 5.5 hours solidly. And on the night of the Paris attacks, which happened in November 2015, I was on air for about 3 hours, 2.5, 3 hours, as we started to understand what had happened in Paris and the enormity of it.
Now, you're sitting at a desk in front of a number of cameras. Mm-hmm. What do you know about what's going on in the world? Are you getting it all through screens that are in front of you that are telling you what's happening? I mean,
so in my desk, set into the desk, I've got a computer which is telling me the running order. What are the stories we're doing in the order that we're doing them? That goes out of the window when there's a big story happening. So everything you've produced and you think you're going to do, you're not doing. So in some ways, although people feel that breaking news is very difficult, in some ways it's the most basic form of journalism. It's the who, what, when, where, why, how questions. You're trying to get to the bottom of what's really going on. And there's a lot of repetition. Also in my desk, there's a big screen split into nine. And they're the OSs, the outside sources. So they can be camera points from all over the world or feeds of pictures that are coming in from anywhere. And they're very useful to me because if I know that we're waiting for the French president to make an announcement live from the Élysée Palace, I can be watching that empty podium. And then when Emmanuel Macron or François Hollande, as it was during the Paris attacks, arrives on the podium, I'm ready to go to hand to Paris to hear what he's got to say. So those screens are very, very useful. They give you sort of forewarning of what's coming in. They can also be live pictures of a security operation that might be underway, as there were several, of course, that night in Paris. So they're very useful to me. But I also get information fed to me in print form. Messages get sent to me a bit like an email. Sometimes social media can be useful, but also be very unhelpful because you need to make sure that you're using verified sources. You don't want to be quoting from some unverified source because that's the way to get into trouble. So we're very circumspect about nailing things down as fact until we've had it verified by a BBC reporter, producer or correspondent.
You get to the studio at a certain time. I don't know what time you get there. If you're on at 6:30, are you there several hours before you so you know what's going on? Or do you prepare for the next hour? How do you get ready for what? Or is there a producer somewhere who's doing it all for you?
TV presenters should never forget that there's a huge team of people behind them, technical people and production people, editorial people, who are giving you what you need to hopefully do a good job. You're the gatekeeper. And anyone who forgets that is heading for a bit of a fall. I'm acutely aware that I work with extremely talented, dedicated and hardworking people. And I hopefully don't mess up all the work that they've done in preparation. So what I tend to do is get into work 1.5 to 2 hours before I'm due on air. That's a sort of standard amount of time that you need to read in. So you're already, of course, keeping across the news. You're listening to the radio in the course of the day. Maybe you've put the telly on in the course of the day. You're catching up on things from websites, newspapers, social media. You're constantly sort of plugged in and keeping abreast of what's happening. The first person I talk to when I come in is the assistant editor, who's the person who is in charge of shaping the output in the time that we're on air. And I will, the main things that I'm interested in are what's going to be live. So what are the stories that we're likely to be doing live interviews on? Who are we talking to? What's their view likely to be? And what's the latest on that particular story? So I will read around that and formulate my own questions. Often we'll have producers who provide you with a guest brief, which is this is who we're talking to, this is why, and this is what their main views are. And then I try to formulate my own questions, because if I can't do that, I don't know why I'm sitting in the chair, really. The other live events that I need to know about are things like, is President Trump going to make a speech from the Rose Garden? An announcement. Is he going to sign a, you know, presidential executive order? And if so, why? So then I would need to be able to talk around that subject, explaining the context, explaining the background and the significance. So they're the things that I will be preparing for before I go on air. And then I tend to go to makeup 45 minutes or an hour before I'm due on air. It takes about 40, 45 minutes to be made camera ready. They're the miracle workers of the BBC. And you're then back upstairs, having hopefully read into all the subjects you're going to be covering while you're in the makeup chair quite often. And then you get into the studio, you put your kit on. So underneath my clothes, in what you can't see, is a big, thick elastic belt with pockets in it, which hold a radio talkback pack and a radio microphone pack, which are hopefully hidden underneath my clothes. And I've got an earpiece in so I can hear what's being said to me from the gallery. And then you're on air, and you turn up 10 minutes before you go on air, and then you're on air on the top of the hour usually, yeah.
Some of what you do is literally the news. Others is where you're interviewing people in the studio. And you're,
yes, or down the line, as we call them. Yes, yeah, details down the line. Yeah.
I was thinking for the moment of what the papers say. We might have a couple of journalists or other experts talking about what's in the papers that day. And you're having to wing that a bit, aren't you?
That's not scripted. Other than we do a quick rundown of what's on the front pages of the newspapers, which we call the stack. And that's where we flip through the graphicised front pages. And they're not actually there. It's called augmented reality graphics. And I turn to look at them, but they're not there. And then they appear on television thanks to the graphic system that we have. But then I have, as you say, two guests, usually journalists, because they have to be able to talk about any subject under the sun. And they've usually come in an hour or so before we go on air at 10:30 and 11:30 to have a look through the papers, to choose the stories. And usually I have read the front pages, but often it's a rather cursory glance. And so it's my job to steer them through the six or seven pages that we've got and that we've chosen.
And there's a time limit?
Yes.
You know how long?
12 to 15 minutes. Sometimes, if we're lucky, we'll do a longer version. So particularly around the Brexit story, sometimes there are some momentous days that require longer for you to sort of pore over the papers. But that's great fun, because for me, the unscripted output, you don't know where it's going to go. It's also the end of the day. It's you're looking ahead to what the papers are going to be reporting on the next morning. And you've got a bit of leg room to have some fun with it, because it is most news, isn't it? It's pretty grim. And it's just nice to have a bit of levity. Somebody asked me, I did an interview, an event a few months back at St Albans Boys School, where it was the politics students, and they asked me a lot of questions. And the one question that I'd never been asked before was, what's the most important thing to get right? And I don't think I've ever been asked that before. And for me, it's tone. Because if your tone's wrong and you sound flippant, or you're making in-jokes that exclude the viewer, that doesn't go down well, quite understandably. And I just think tone is the most important thing. So although we have a bit of fun on the papers, and I hope it comes across that I enjoy my job, because I certainly do, and I think it's a huge privilege to do it, as long as you get your tone right, in the right places, you can have a bit of fun with it.
It's said with radio that you need to think that you're talking to a person.
That's what I was told.
Is that what you do on television?
Yes, I do. Alistair Stewart on ITV News was asked on social media recently, well, we were both asked, who do you think of when you broadcast? And Alistair said, a family of four, which is very Alistair. And I said, an intelligent acquaintance. So it's someone who you know a little bit, but you're not overly familiar like your best friend. And it's someone who is smart, is switched on, is interested in the news. In some cases, will know more than you do about subjects. And so that helps me, I hope, pitch things at the right level.
You have to be aware of a lot of different things. You don't have to have in-depth knowledge of a lot of different things, other than, I guess, at the moment, politics, because politics is so dominant. But do you read a lot? Do you think, or do you have time to read around? I mean, you read 12 papers a day?
No, well, I read bits and pieces of lots of different things. And I remember a long time ago when I worked in local radio, we were told there is no right paper to read, there's no wrong paper to read. Your listeners will be reading a range of different newspapers, so it's a good idea to read a range of different views. And a lot of the stuff that I read now is online. I've subscribed to online newspapers, and I read a lot of long reads that I would never have come across before because social media takes you to those places. And I find that has sort of broadened my reading in some ways. And I know it's difficult for newspapers because they're competing with all of that and they're trying to find a model whereby they can be online and still make a profit. I just also make myself follow people on social media who I don't agree with. Or otherwise, you create this little bubble, an echo chamber for yourself. And it's really good to be challenged all the time.
It's like if you only read The Guardian or you only read the Mail, you're getting two completely different worldviews.
Yes, and people tend to read the newspaper that supports their view in the first place. And of course, as you know, I'm not allowed to express an opinion on the BBC, and I hope that I don't. And it also, doing this job, it does make you see the different sides. You're like, well, I can see on the one hand, but I can see on the other. And so you almost find it difficult to express an opinion sometimes in the end because you get so used to not doing so.
You obviously enjoy what you do. What's the best type of television that you do? Do you want to do other things?
Well, yeah, I'd whatever they'd like to offer me, really. But I recently, which was a total departure for me, I was on the red carpet at the BAFTAs at the Royal Albert Hall. And I hadn't done that before. And it was supposed to be an hour and a quarter of live broadcasting. And again, we had no script. We had no real structure because you don't know who's coming down the red carpet. I had two guests, Jason Solomons, a film critic who could talk about every film that was nominated, and Maria Grashvogel, who is a fashion designer, and she was able to talk about all of the wonderful gowns that the women in particular were wearing, although there were quite a few men who veered away from the usual, you know, black tie this year. And in the end, we were on air for an extra half an hour because we were waiting for the royals to arrive, William and Kate, and they were running late, so it meant we stayed on air. And we did an hour and three quarters, unscripted, no auto cue, and it was wonderful. You fling yourself on air, you kind of know where you're going, and you're making it up as you go along. And Lizo Mazimba, who is our entertainment correspondent, was on the red carpet. We were handing to him when he was, you know, talking to Olivia Colman or Bill Nighy or whoever. And he spoke to a lot of the really big name stars. And we made apparently what was a very nice programme. And I'd never done it before and I loved it. So live TV takes a lot of beating. And for me, it feels like a very safe space. I suppose because I've been doing it such a long time. It's almost like my living room now, the studio I'm in. And that's how I think and hope we're able to be quite sort of relaxed and conversational about it, given the fact you are constrained by the grammar of TV news.
Mm-hmm. You know, tempted to go and make documentaries? You've got the production experience, you've got the writing, you've got a fairly good skill set.
Yes, I've made rates a few a long, long time ago, made a few radio documentaries. I think the problem with doing live news is you love the immediacy and the urgency of it. And so documentaries which take quite a long time to make, I'm not sure I've got the patience. It's a very different approach to have. But yeah, I've got some ideas of things that I'd like to make. But it's just a case of finding the right commissioning editor because the commissioning process can be a bit of a mystery.
When I was young, newsreaders were all men.
And they sounded very different from me because I am conscious that I do have a regional accent and to a lot of people in Hertfordshire, I will sound very northern probably.
I wouldn't think so. I was thinking of the various comments made that, you know, when we moved on from the men who used to sit there in their dinner jackets, as it were, reading the news, there are a lot more women in now than there were before, aren't there?
There are.
People like me don't even notice whether you look at it, as it were.
No, I'm glad about that because I think you've really got somewhere when you stop noticing that somebody is different as
even
they would have been.
Even though the viewer is aware that the man can turn up in a suit and the woman has to think what she dresses in.
Yes, I think it was a newsreader in New Zealand who deliberately wore the same suit for a whole year and nobody noticed, whereas, of course, if I wore the same dress 2 days on the trot, somebody would notice. Yeah, it is a peculiar thing because the question I get asked most often is, do they do your hair and makeup? When I'd rather be asked about how do you approach an interview. But it's a consideration. TV is a visual medium. You need to look the part. Nothing about you needs to stand out. You know, you don't want your hair sticking up on end. Your jewellery needs to be sort of symmetrical. You don't want dangly earrings that are distracting. So it's about looking professional without there being anything that stands out too much.
But also maintaining that relationship with the viewer, which is what you talked about earlier, where you're thinking that you're talking to somebody.
Yeah, that was one of the first things I was ever taught when I went into broadcasting, is that you don't listen as a group. You listen and watch as an individual. And that comes down to things like, I was taught, don't say, hello, everyone. Just say hello. And also don't say things like, oh, you've written into us. Well, no, I haven't. Viewers have written into us, they've texted us or whatever. So I'm quite careful about it. Maybe I'm a bit old-fashioned, I don't know, because some of these conventions seem to fall by the wayside a bit. But I like to be talked to as an individual, and that's where the best broadcasters get it right for me. And so that's what I'm aiming for, really. But the BBC has got a project called 50-50, and we're trying to make sure that we've got a 50% split between male and female contributors. We're getting there. Mm. You know, it's a cultural change, and it's just reminding yourself as a producer to think differently, to try and invite different voices onto the output.
Women are going into aspects of broadcasting where they wouldn't go before. I mean, I'm thinking of the foreign correspondents that go into war zones. I know it faces as much danger as any reporter has ever
faced.
Yeah,
why shouldn't they? Yeah, I mean, there's a long history of women as war correspondents. Martha Gellhorn, of course, who was married to Ernest Hemingway, is the one that immediately springs to mind. But some of our finest correspondents, I'm thinking of Lise Doucette or Le Guerin, they go everywhere and face the same dangers that their male colleagues would face.
And the fact that we have changed significantly, we've still got a way to go. You say the 50-50 is a project, you haven't got there yet. That will go on. What's the next thing for television news? How far the social media are not undermining it, but presenting challenges to the news all the time, because you're trying to present not fake news, but real news.
Yes.
And you're surrounded by potentially fake news coming in from other sources. And we're trying to pick our way through all this. Where are we going next?
Well, we have a team called Reality Check who will get hold of a subject around which there is confusion, or there is disinformation, or there's received wisdom, and you go to town and you do a proper journalist job, and you pick up the phone and you speak to experts, or you get facts verified. And Reality Check is just proper journalism, checking that you've got the right version of events. And of course, that doesn't mean that opinions around that subject won't differ. Of course they will. And we need to try and reflect, not extreme views, but we need to try and reflect a broad church.
We're in difficult times because a lot of people are obsessed with conspiracies. Everything is a conspiracy. Everybody's always attacked the BBC. The left attacks BBC for being right-wing. The right-wing attacks BBC for being left-wing. So you must be doing something right in the middle.
Let's hope so.
It's probably true that those who are looking for a certain, as you mentioned with newspapers, those who are looking for a certain sort of truth will not necessarily look at television news. They'll go to certain social media which fulfil their wishes and fantasies.
Yeah, and the BBC is very aware that habits are changing and people have a choice about how and where they get their news from. And it is a challenge. And we are seeing a bit of an erosion in viewing figures, but we still have respectable viewing figures. And this is where the BBC recognises that if it wants to attract a broad range of audience, we have to have a broad range of output and programmes that will appeal to everybody. And you can't please everyone all the time, but we're going to try.
Just going back right to the beginning, you took a traditional route through from what was traditional, I don't know if it still is, which is local radio station, getting work experience, then going into local television, then into the national television and global television and so on. Is that still available? Is that route still available?
Yes, it is. A lot of people tend to do an undergraduate degree, and I think the best newsrooms are populated by people with degrees in all sorts of different subjects. So you've got experts in economics and politics and history and the arts. even, you know, the sciences, we really, science journalism is very difficult to do well. A lot of people then go on and do a postgraduate diploma, which is a one-year course usually, which teaches you the skills of broadcasting, editing and interviewing. And then the BBC runs highly, highly contested, very competitive training courses. It also, in the last few years, has started to introduce digital journalism apprenticeships to try to attract people who haven't necessarily been to university. I went and talked to a group of them at the BBC's training centre at Wood Norton in the Vale of Evesham a couple of years ago, and they were all in their late teens, early 20s, none had been to university, and they were from very diverse backgrounds. One had been working in a chip shop, one had been working in a garden centre, another one had been unemployed. But these were young people who had really brilliant storytelling skills in digital form. So they were bloggers and vloggers, and they could write really well for the website. They were also taught radio and television as well, so that they understood how all the different types of journalism within the BBC fit together. And that's proved to be very popular, because we're trying to reach people who don't think necessarily that the BBC is the kind of place where they would work, if they feel that they don't see and hear people who are like them on radio and television. And it's trying to change that.
Martin, we've, as they don't say in television, we've run out of time.
Well, you're not meant to say that.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
Next, we bring you a Rupert Evershed Nature Note about how to help the poor old hedgehogs who are struggling to survive.
This is Rupert Evershed reading my monthly Nature Notes column for the Hearts Advertiser. Be untidy for hedgehogs. A couple of weeks ago, I walked out into the garden on what must have been one of the first warm nights this year and encountered a hedgehog. 5 or 6 years ago, this would not have been much to report, as they were familiar residents in our garden, turning up in bonfire heaps, thankfully discovered before lighting, under the chicken house, and generally making their presence known with their snuffling hog noises on summer's nights. However, they have been absent from my garden for at least 4 or 5 years, something that only dawned on me a few years ago as I realised that I too was experiencing the national trend of hedgehog population decline. It was a very sad thought that these familiar little animals, perhaps the ultimate non-cuddly, cuddly creature, might not actually ever visit our garden again. In my mind, I began to relegate it to the archives of lost flora and fauna over the years, that included the spotted flycatchers that nested every year above our porch, and the swallow that nested under the roof. Both these birds disappeared during the 1980s, and have not been back since. It felt that maybe the hedgehog was to go the same way too. So you can imagine my joy when all of a sudden a snuffling ball of spikes bumbled across my path in the dark as I went out to shut the chickens and ducks in. I wished him or her well and suggested that he or she might find a mate and get on with saving the hedgehog population. And sure enough, a few nights later the snuffling had increased, and there, by the potting shed, were not just one but two hedgehogs, nose to nose, making each other's acquaintance. Hopefully they will find a suitable home and raise some young and keep the hedgehog's hopes alive a bit longer, for the forecast is dismal. It has been estimated that hedgehogs, without a concerted conservation effort on our part, could die out in the UK within the next 20 years. That conservation effort is best carried out by each one of us who happen to be guardians of the hedgehog's greatest hope for survival, the garden. Hedgehogs love gardens, but over the last few decades have encountered an increasing number of barriers. Impenetrable fences instead of hedges, patio and gravel-covered areas instead of rough grass, and plastic compost bins instead of compost heaps. This urge to tidy our gardens has been spurred on by garden makeover programmes on TV. But in reality, we are all apt to want to tidy, especially at this time of year with our gardens springing back to life. However, nature is not tidy, and the result of an over-tidy garden can be catastrophic for the hedgehog. Without any rough areas of decaying leaves and wood, the hedgehog cannot find a home, or the insects and grubs they need to feed on. Although hedgehogs eat a wide variety of scavenged morsels, they are known to be partial to slugs, not a bad thing for gardeners. But with the increased use of slug pellets comes an increased risk of poisoning for the hedgehog too. The charity Bug Life has recently warned gardeners that we could experience a population explosion of giant slugs this year, thanks to the wet and mild weather over the winter. What better way to combat such an invasion than to encourage hedgehogs back as a natural control, rather than using chemicals hazardous to wildlife? It is not easy resisting the urge to tidy every square inch of the garden, but even a little bit of planned untidiness can go a long way. Leaving an area of lawn uncut and creating a pile of dead wood and leaves could provide a vital home for a hedgehog. You could even go as far as building a hedgehog house, really just a box accessed via a 5-inch square tunnel and filled with leaves and straw. Of course, like bird boxes, you can buy purpose-made hedgehog houses, but making one can be fun. In addition, make sure your garden fences have hedgehog-sized holes somewhere along the base. It is estimated that hedgehogs travel between 1 to 2 kilometres every night. With Hedgehog Awareness Week this month and hedgehogs entering their busy breeding season, it is a great time to give a little thought to these unassuming animals of Beatrix Potter fame. Why not get involved in helping make your neighbourhood a hedgehog haven and sign up at www.hedgehogstreet.org, where you can become a hedgehog champion and learn a lot more about how to help Britain's favourite mammal.
Now a short story written especially for TNF Soundings by Chris Crowther. It's set on the Norfolk Broads, where ex-Scotland Yard detective Jack Fellows now patrols as a river ranger. In this story, he works alongside a visually impaired army veteran.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, this is Amanda, with a short story written especially for Talking Newspaper listeners by author Chris Crowther. Chris spent many years as a pilot. Then, after his retirement from flying, he spent 5 years as a skipper on passenger boats in the Norfolk Broads. Chris has published 9 full-length novels about ex-Scotland Yard detective Jack Fellows, who now patrols as a river ranger, assisting boaters and enforcing bylaws while using his old police instincts to suss trouble. This short story, featuring a visually impaired main character, has been written especially for TNF Soundings to share with Talking Newspaper listeners. This story is titled Beyond the Call. Considering the significance military service would play in the events to come, it was perhaps appropriate that Jack should first meet Cathy Winton below the remains of the old Roman fort at Birr Castle. Half a mile back, he'd entered the Waveney, his favourite southern river, flowing down to Alton, Broad and Beccles. Passing the old fort, he pondered how, 17 centuries before, it had guarded the estuary against increasing Saxon raids. Now all that remained were 3 flint walls, and the only invaders, the numerous leisure craft that, in this busy holiday period, were already churning the river's surface. Alongside the castle moorings on this warm, sunny day were 3 such boats, a medium-sized motor cruiser and 2 traditional wooden sailing yachts named Sunburst and Sundog. On the latter, some lads in their early teens were busy washing decks, while in the cockpit of the other, 4 girls of the same age were seated with 2 young women. In the summer months, various youth organisations hired sailing cruisers, like these, for a week's adventure afloat, and Jack was sure this small flotilla was one such group. Mooring up, he made his way to Sunburst, where the slightly older of the 2 adults was teaching rope work to the girl crew. "Okay," she encouraged. "Now you've learnt the bowline, try and do one with your eyes closed." As the youngsters set about their challenge, Jack took the opportunity to introduce himself as the River Ranger.
"How's the holiday going?"
The woman looked up through wraparound sunglasses and smiled. "Oh, wonderful, thanks. Come and join us." She held out her hand. "I'm Cathy Winton. She nodded towards the other young woman in the cockpit. And this is Gemma, my sighted first mate.
Good to meet you, said Jack, and to see you teaching some of the old skills.
Kathy shrugged. That's what our group's all about, showing youngsters that there's no limit to what they can do. She removed her sunglasses, whatever their personal circumstances. Now Jack understood Kathy's use of the word sighted, for he could see that this young woman's eyes were sightless and surrounded by a veritable web of healed scar tissue.
Well, they couldn't wish for better inspiration, Kathy.
We try, she said, popping her shades back on and indicating the two adults on Sundog, moored just ahead. Jim, the lad's leader, has a prosthetic leg, and Henry, his mate, took part in the last Paralympics.
A great team indeed.
Jack nodded to the motor cruiser moored ahead of them.
How about that boat? Is it part of your group?
Oh, you mean Vixen? Kathy's tone hardened slightly. No, that belongs to an elderly ex-major called Bertie Barraclough, who somehow latched onto us, always wanting to help and very keen to relate all his war stories to the children. In the corner of the cockpit, Gemma smiled. I think he's just lonely, really, and the youngsters are always keen to hear what he has to say. But he's an unwanted distraction and keeps following us around, complained Kathy, before cocking an ear towards Vixen. Actually, Jack, I can hear his hatch opening, so you'll be able to judge for yourself. Kathy's sharp hearing was proved correct. As a broad-shouldered, slightly stocky man in his mid-60s emerged from the cruiser, pausing only to smooth his military-looking moustache before heading straight for Sundog.
Morning, lads. Lovely day.
Major Barraclough's booming voice had probably served him well in the army. Oh, morning, Major. The four boys needed little encouragement to cease their mopping and chat. Yes, looks like another hot one.
But not as hot as some of the places I served,
bellowed the Major.
I remember back in Aden, like an oven, and me and my platoon fighting our way out of a dead-end wad. Got me the DSC, though, so...
But he got no further before Leader Jim intervened. A fascinating tale, I'm sure, Major, but we're off upriver soon, so these boys need to get this boat cleaned and ship-shape.
Oh, right,
grunted the old soldier regretfully, before shuffling off to leave the lads begrudgingly resuming their cleaning. See what I mean? Said Kathy. Jack stroked his chin.
He does seem keen to reminisce, but surely service to your country isn't a bad thing for youngsters to hear about.
I agree, Jack, but only if it's true, because some of Barraclough's tales go way beyond the realms of probability. Like him telling the boys just now that he'd won the DSC in Aden. That surely can't be true, seeing as the Distinguished Service Cross is purely a naval decoration.
Good point, Kathy,
agreed Jack.
But you seem to know a lot about the military yourself.
That's because I was in Afghanistan as a medic. She tapped her sunglasses. Which is how I ended up like this.
You mean you lost your sight serving your country?
Kathy nodded. By stepping on an AED when I was running to help a wounded soldier.
Probably through being too dedicated, admired Jack. But rotten luck on you.
She shrugged. I did at least survive, but having experienced active service makes me very suspicious of heroic tales like Barraclough's.
Okay,
conceded Jack.
But he's not the first veteran to embroider his war service.
But Kathy was in no mood for moderation. Perhaps not, but he just won't leave us alone, and he's beginning to undermine our authority. Surely that can't be right.
Not when youngsters are involved,
agreed Jack.
So let me check things out.
Give me your mobile number and I'll get back to you. Jack nodded towards Barraclough, just climbing back aboard Vixen. Perhaps by then, Major Bertie will have found someone else to bore. If only, grinned Cathy back. Jack was thankful for next afternoon's enduring sunshine as the Waveney carried his patrol launch upriver between the riverside dwellings and boatyards of St. Olaf's. True to his promise, he'd called his old contact at Scotland Yard and requested any information they had on Major Bertie Barraclough. Having received a reply that same evening, he then called Cathy, been told the flotilla was night-stopping at St. Olaf's, and arranged to rendezvous there the next day. And so here he was, with the tall masts of the sailboats easy to spot, amongst several other hire craft, moored beside a working boatyard. He looked for Vixen, and spotted the cruiser lying several boats away, with Barraclough sitting on his cabin roof, droning on to a young couple, standing patiently listening on the quay below. On the sailboats, only Cathy could be seen, busying herself in Sunburst's cockpit. Jack swung his launch into the tide and was soon alongside. "Good to see you again," greeted Cathy, smiling as she made fast the launch's lines. "Come aboard."
"What happened to the others?"
asked Jack once he'd joined her in Sunburst's cockpit. "Off exploring the village's old Augustinian priory, leaving me to brush up on my splicing." She picked up a length of 3-strand rope with an ice splice worked into one end. "My next lesson for the girls."
"All good stuff."
Jack glanced 200 yards down the quay to where Vixen lay moored adjacent to the boatyard's open work area. Here several boats were laid up ashore, supported by wooden props and chocks, and providing tempting hidey-holes for a little girl and 2 small boys, happily playing hide-and-seek in between them. Jack guessed them to be the offspring of the couple still being lectured by the voluble Barraclough. He turned back to Cathy.
"I see our Major Bertie has found a new audience for his tales."
"Yes, poor them," agreed Cathy with a little chuckle. He arrived too late yesterday to moor next to us and had to settle for that slot further down." She paused and frowned. "But you said your inquiries had produced results, Jack. Anything we should know?"
"I think so. The fact is that..."
But Jack was suddenly stopped mid-sentence by a piercing scream from further down the quay. It came from the yard's laid-up boats, one of which was now heeled over at a perilous angle, as 2 small boys scrambled from beneath. That left the little girl, probably still there, and somehow trapped. Jack grabbed Cathy by the shoulder.
"There's been an accident. Come on, we may need your medical skills."
Helping her ashore, they both ran down the quay, Cathy holding Jack's shoulder for guidance. Fast as they ran, however, Jack could see that they had been beaten to the scene by no other than Bertie Barraclough. While the young parents stood frozen with shock, he had leapt from atop his cabin and sprinted straight to the listing boat, with its 1 remaining support already splintering under the strain. Without hesitation, Bertie dived headlong beneath to wedge his broad shoulders under the turn of its bilge, adding not only support, but even raising the boat just enough for the little girl to free herself.
"Get out!"
yelled Bertie, as the remaining prop creaked and splintered some more. The girl scuttled free, but even as she did, there came an even more ominous crack from the remaining prop, as it gave way completely, and the boat rolled onto its beam ends with a force beyond even Bertie's strength. Arriving at the scene, Jack and Cathy were met with only a cloud of dust and the old soldier's agonized groans from beneath. Other witnesses dashed to the scene, but Jack held them back.
"You ladies get the children away from here and one of you call an ambulance, now. You men help me raise this boat."
It was wood-built and heavy, but with 6 of them heaving, they managed just a momentary lift while others pushed in temporary chocks. Precarious as that was, Kathy felt her way beneath and began examining the stricken Bertie. "One leg is badly crushed," she called back. "Get me something I can roll him onto so you can pull him out." Some old carpet was swiftly produced, and a groaning Bertie was carefully pulled free. An exhausted Kathy knelt beside him, offering what comfort she could, until the urgent wail of an ambulance meant his pain would soon be eased, at least a little. "So how did it happen?" Jim, back from the group's run ashore and anxious to hear Jack and Kathy's explanation of the drama enacted just a half hour before, had quickly joined them in Sunburst's cockpit.
"A pure accident," explained Jack. "Apparently one of the children dislodged a prop and over the boat went."
"Trapping a little girl who's only alive now, thanks to Bertie's brave action," added Kathy.
"But leaving him injured," frowned Jim, whose concern was only amplified by the ambulance's siren as it sped out of the yard. "How badly?"
Kathy looked crestfallen. "He'll probably survive, but that leg is badly crushed, and he'll be lucky to keep it."
"Amputation?"
It was clear Jim was recalling his own past trauma.
"Well, if it comes to that, I'll be only too glad to give all the help and support I can. It's the least I can do for a hero like Bertie."
He glanced towards Sundog and all the youngsters gathered on board, looking sad.
"They're pretty cut up, so I'd better get back and reassure them."
As Jim hurried off, two other figures appeared beside Sunburst. It was the little girl Bertie had rescued, together with her mum. Both still looked badly shaken, but they had come over to thank Kathy for all she did. The mother glanced in the direction of the ambulance's siren, its wail growing ever distant as it sped on its urgent way.
"That poor man, we owe Lucy's life to him."
She gave her daughter a thankful squeeze.
"He was such a hero. Just a minute before he'd been recalling his own brave adventures and then, without a moment's thought, risked his life again to save Lucy."
After words of comfort, they left to return to their boat while Kathy turned back to Jack.
"And to think, I've done nothing these last few days but badmouth poor Bertie."
Jack laid a comforting hand on her shoulder.
"That was just between you and me, Kathy, and nothing to feel guilty about. Having, I suspect, been decorated yourself for bravery, it must have upset you knowing his stories weren't true. You were just voicing concern for the youngsters in your care."
"Perhaps," she shook away regretful thoughts. "But before the accident, you were about to tell me what you'd found out about his past."
"If you still want to hear it."
She shrugged. "If it helps ease my conscience, Jack, then go ahead."
"Okay, well, records show that Bertie Barraclough did indeed serve in the army, though not with the distinction he would have everyone believe. For a start, it wasn't as an officer, but as a lowly squaddie, and even that ended in May 1982.
Kathy mulled over that date.
"Wasn't that the start of the Falklands War?"
Jack nodded.
"Yep, and Bertie's unit were the first to be deployed. But he wasn't with them, because he did a bunk the night before embarkation."
"He deserted," gasped Kathy, "to avoid active service."
"Seems that way," confirmed Jack. "After arrest, he was court-martialed and did a spell in detention before receiving a dishonourable discharge."
Kathy went quiet, and Jack could imagine her thinking of the little girl so narrowly clutched from tragedy. Then she finally said, with a smile,
"But Jack, what you've just told me, that surely can't be our Major Bertie."
Jack glanced down quay to where the little family sat subdued, but safe. Perhaps the past was where some things were best left.
"No, you're absolutely right, Kathy. It couldn't possibly be our Bertie.
DNF Soundings.
And that brings our magazine programme to a close. Thanks to Goffby for our theme music, Briefly Encountered, to Alison for collecting all the wallets that you return, and thanks to you for listening. We hope you enjoyed and maybe even informed by our selection today. May I wish you a very pleasant summer, hopefully not too hot. Keep drinking fluids, water mostly. Meanwhile, bye for now.